What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome to Success Story. I'm your host, Scott Clary. The Success Story podcast is part of the HubSpot podcast network. They have great podcasts you should go listen to, but they also have great technology that can help your business. The big reason why more than 300 of last year's unicorn startups use HubSpot is because there is no other software that keeps you better connected with your teams and your customers so you can crush all your business, sales, revenue, marketing goals. The new HubSpot Sales Hub brings you that power of an easy-to-use platform designed for today's top entrepreneurs, today's top sales teams. With 360-degree deal management and real-time reporting, you get accurate windows into every inch of your business. And with AI-powered tools like their new ChatSpot, you'll have a dedicated assistant that knows your business inside and out. ChatSpot enables your team with one-stop access to a ton of time-saving functions like pulling data, tracking calls, managing leads, scheduling emails. So trade cold calls for warm leads, because when it comes to scaling sales, your software should be smart. And the solutions should be simple. Get on track for your best Q1 yet. Check out HubSpot Sales Hub at HubSpot.com/sales. Today, my guest is Samson Mo. He's currently the CEO of Pixelmatic, the development studio behind Infinite Fleet, as well as the CEO of Jan3, a new Bitcoin technology company with a mission to accelerate hyper-Bitcoinization. Samson is known for his work on El Salvador's Bitcoin strategy and nation-state Bitcoin adoption in general. He was previously CSO at Blockstream, a leading provider of Bitcoin infrastructure. And before joining Blockstream, he was the COO at BTC China, one of the largest Bitcoin exchanges and mining pools in the world. At BTCC, Samson oversaw day-to-day operations of the company and directly managed the exchange and mining pool business units. Now, we spoke about the block size war, Bitcoin maximalism, adoption of crypto by nation states, why Ethereum is a security and a shitcoin, scaling Bitcoin, and why Bitcoin will be the best way we save ourselves from tyrannical governments and Orwellian 1984 societies. Pick a point in your life, a pivotal point in your life, that sets you on the path to who you are today. It could be something that got you involved in Bitcoin. It could be something that got you involved in tech. It could have been something your parents did that made you gravitate towards one industry category or the other. So pick that point. We'll go from there.
So everything first started when I first read about Bitcoin mining. So this is the inflection point at which I understood that Bitcoin was decentralized and it was unique. Many people have heard about Bitcoin and they gloss over it and they read about it in the media, and it's often portrayed in a very bad light. But most people understand Bitcoin is just a digital currency or a virtual currency. But when I first read about Bitcoin mining, that was when I really dug into the details. And I understood that it's an open system that is permissionless, that has nobody controlling it. Because when you understand Bitcoin mining, you understand anybody can join in and secure the network, audit the network, and actually run the back-end systems of Bitcoin themselves.
And so you already from day one, you went into the weeds. Like you obviously are a very technical individual. You jumped into the weeds, but you decided to build a company in Bitcoin mining. Why as opposed to, or go ahead. Sorry.
So that was my initial foray. So you told me to pick the moment, right? So after that, it took me a while before I guess I officially got into Bitcoin. And I say that is when I joined BTC China. That was a Bitcoin exchange based in China. So this is like the inflection point, but then there's another long journey into it.
Okay, so then what was your, so you know about Bitcoin, you just learned casually about Bitcoin mining. Did you like spin up some S9? I don't even know what year it was. Like what did you like figure out how to order an S9 and like try and like hook it up in your house, your condo, and realize it was like super loud and super hot? Or like what's the first foray into Bitcoin mining?
Well, this was 2013, I believe. So okay. I tried super to set early. Up on my laptop, but people were already early. Using yeah. GPUs and maybe FPGAs at the time. S9s were not out yet, but I couldn't mine anything on my laptop, unfortunately. But at least that was the point at which I understood Bitcoin. But I didn't really get into it until I joined BTC China in late 2014, early 2015. And I was the COO there, and it was a Bitcoin exchange and mining pool. But that's really the start of the journey down the rabbit hole into, you know, all the things that I'm doing today with nation state Bitcoin adoption and Gen 3.
Do you think that somebody has to understand Bitcoin mining to understand Bitcoin? Is that important or is that more in the weeds?
Not at all. I would say because I'm a game developer by trade, so I build virtual worlds with economies and it's all centrally controlled, right? You have a game currency, you have to manage the game currency. And for me, it was understanding Bitcoin in that context, that there was nobody controlling the currency, that really sparked that light bulb aha moment for myself. But anybody can understand Bitcoin. You can read the white paper. I actually read the white paper after I set up all my Bitcoin mining systems. But like people can go into Bitcoin in different ways, and they don't need to mine Bitcoin to understand Bitcoin.
I was always curious about that because we always still are, even today, I feel like we're solving for the problem of understanding and adoption, right? Like how many, well, I mean, 2013, now we're almost 10 years later. So I've always wondered if people went more into the weeds or if there's other adoption problems that you've seen, because you've been in this for such a long time. Now, okay, so you joined BTCC as COO. So walk me through that career decision. So were you in Bitcoin professionally before, or was this something that was just more of a hobby? And then this is like your first foray, because COO of a large company is that's significant.
Well, you have to remember everything was a bit smaller back then. Like BTC China had about 18% of hash rate, which was not a lot of computing power back then. But these days, 18% is very substantial, right? Because everything has grown. But I was running my game company, Pixelmatic, and then my friend was running BTC China, and our offices were just a kitty corner from each other. So he asked me to come on as an advisor originally. So I went in and helped them set up a mobile app development team and started working on some other things. And eventually he just said, why don't you step in as COO? So I had to learn a lot very rapidly about the entire business and about Bitcoin. But prior to that, I was just reading about Bitcoin and observing from the sidelines. But I would say, once I was in a Bitcoin company, that was when you started getting really deep into it. And also at that point, the Bitcoin block size war was kicking off too, the sort of Bitcoin civil war where all the Bitcoin companies were trying to lobby for a block size increase and changing the rules of the protocol. And I kind of got sucked into that battle.
And even describe to me, like there's a lot of entrepreneurs that listen to this show. You were an entrepreneur building out your own company. When you translate some of those lessons to a disruptive tech like Bitcoin, blockchain, as stepping into the COO role of BTC China, how did you find some of those skills translated? Like, how do you build a company in an emerging industry? There's no playbook, there's no rule book. What's the takeaway? You still have some hair left, so you're good. But I mean, it probably was pretty stressful.
Well, the most stressful part, I would say, was just understanding how exchanges operate and how all the different mechanics work, because there are new products being built all the time on top of Bitcoin and things like margin lending, derivatives and things like that. So that was probably new for me, but running a big company was not really anything new. So before I started Pixelmatic, I was actually an executive at Ubisoft. And I helped them build a game studio in Western China from the ground up to about 200 some odd people. So I had the experience running a large team for a public company. And I think that is valuable experience in a disruptive new tech. Because a lot of tech companies, and as you're aware, they may have an idea and they may have some traction, but they're typically inexperienced on the company management side. So I brought a lot of that, even-handed management and scaling of the organization itself and running it. So at the end, when I left BTC China, I was in charge of the mining pool and the exchange business units and a lot of the core services around operations and the business itself.
And I'm assuming like now, you know, several years later, like the whole industry has evolved. And I think this is something that we start to see in emerging industries, even like cannabis. Like day one, a lot of passionate, product-focused operators and entrepreneurs. And then you start to have some experience and you start to have people that have, you know, built, scaled, sold, and then those people are rolled back in. So the whole industry evolves. So after you left BTC China, this is probably where, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you spent the majority of your Bitcoin career at Blockstream, correct? And walk me through that career decision. Why Blockstream? What were you trying to solve for? So you were CSO there. I'm pretty sure that was out of Canada, out of Toronto, if I'm not mistaken.
Actually, out of Victoria.
It was still in Victoria too. You've been in Vancouver for a while. Okay, gotcha. It's still Canada, West Coast. Gotcha.
Well, Blockstream is a Canadian company. Technically, it's incorporated in Montreal, but we just marked Victoria as the HQ because I was here. But
I got none of the spots right.
close enough. But the Montreal office is really like a back office of finance people and, you know, a mailing address. But people would contact us all the time and say, can we meet? You're in Montreal. So we would just say, okay, HQ is in Victoria. At least now I can meet them and, you know, do the BD and discussions there. But yeah, the entry into Blockstream was really just meeting Dr. Adam Back. He is the CEO of Blockstream, and our paths crossed during the Bitcoin scaling wars, because it was the big blockers on one side and then the small blockers, the people trying to preserve the consensus rule set on the other side. So we were kind of fighting side by side against the big onslaught of the every single Bitcoin company and mining company, right? So we built up a relationship and working repertoire. And I decided to join Blockstream because I understood from that battle that things had to happen and Bitcoin infrastructure had to be improved so that we can weather the next storm.
Can you go deeper on that fight that you're trying to fight? Because a lot of people who aren't in the weeds would not understand what's going on here. Like how are people fighting over Bitcoin?
Right. So it was an innocuous change. It's just saying we want more scale, higher throughput. So more transactions in blocks. And the method that the big block camp wanted to use to accomplish that was increasing the block size, like 4 megabyte, 10 megabyte, 32 megabyte blocks, and so forth. And a number of them have branched off and made their own chains, and they're basically unused. But the small block camp wanted to scale in layers, much like the internet. So you have physical cables, then you have TCP/IP, HTTP, and then you have apps on top, and then CDNs and everything like that. So it's not trying to increase the pipes at the bottom, but build in a structured layer to scale the technology. And we do this through things like the Lightning Network and the Liquid Network, but layers that sit on top of the base. But the slippery slope here is if you start changing a fundamental rule of Bitcoin. So the block size is one such fundamental rule, and then you have other rules which people are more familiar with, like the 21 million cap. But if you can change this rule, that you can change any of the rules, and then Bitcoin just becomes like a fiat currency. Some people will just dictate what happens, monetary policy, etc., etc., and Bitcoin just becomes meaningless. So if Bitcoin actually increased the block sizes and scaled in that method, then it would have been impossible for an average user to run a Bitcoin node on, say, their laptop or old computer. But that's really the key to Bitcoin's success, resilience, and longevity. The fact that individuals can run a Bitcoin node and verify the entire network themselves, rather than outsourcing that to, say, Amazon, someone running a big, powerful server on Amazon, or by extension, a bank. Because then you're just right back in the original territory where we left, right? You're back into centralized control by a small number of people, which you have no access to. You at best have read access to what they allow you to read. But the whole point of Bitcoin is that you yourself run a node. You are an active enforcer of the rules of the network. So this was, in a nutshell, what we were fighting for, just Bitcoin's soul.
And because I think that if somebody starts to understand how Bitcoin operates and somebody could literally amass, maybe walk me through why someone could not amass a data center or just a ton of servers and be an actor that could manipulate.
Yeah, so I think what you're getting into is the 51% attack, the mining attack, right? Amassing a large amount of machinery, ASICs, and then going to attack the network to rewrite the chain. Now, that it's been theorized a lot of times, and you actually don't need 51% attack. You could probably sustain an attack with 30 or 40% of the hash rate. But the challenge is, how does one accumulate that much hashing power? And accumulating that much hashing power in stealth mode, because if it's like, let's say, a nation state attack, you'd have to basically buy, you know, gigawatts of power, build out a large farm, and then buy ASICs from the suppliers or from the market. And you could not do that without the market realizing what's happening. So it's very difficult to pull off this as a stealth move. And if it's known, then other actors in the space can counter that move because they themselves can ramp up and acquire more ASICs themselves, right? But the key here is that Bitcoin runs on a proof-of-work model, not proof-of-stake, which is what Ethereum and other very malleable protocols use. So the problem with proof-of-stake is you have this pie, right? You have the stake. And their theory of security is that if you wanted to attack it, you'd have to buy a stake, and therefore, you know, it wouldn't work. But the problem is you can co-opt a stake too, which is what happened to Ethereum. So people delegated responsibility out to the exchanges. So most of the exchanges now are staking on behalf of the user. So you kind of have this self-inflicted centralization where, you know, the big entities now have control of it. But the problem is you cannot expand the stake. You have that pie. And like, let's say, you know, it's under attack and you have another actor, like you yourself want to expand the pie. You can't do that because it's the stake. Whereas with Bitcoin mining, you have this much hash rate now, but let's say the US was going to attack. Let's say El Salvador wants to defend. El Salvador can manufacture their own silicon, make their ASICs, make the miners, get energy, and add to the pie because there's no upper limit to proof of work. You can keep adding more and more work to the pie.
All so it makes it defensible. It makes it more defensible.
You just need work, right? You have to build it, deploy it, but you can secure it because there's no upper bound.
I understand. Okay, so this is really what you were fighting for. And this is this actually Blockstream's, like, what was Blockstream's mission? I know this is something you were very passionate about, but what was Blockstream's mission as a company?
Well, I would say Blockstream's mission is to augment Bitcoin, right? Building technologies to scale Bitcoin like Lightning and like Liquid. So these second layer or even third layers in the future of ways to scale Bitcoin. Because one of the attack vectors during the block size wars was Bitcoin is too slow. 7 transactions a second, it's not enough for the world. But it's not meant to be. The main chain level is not meant to scale to transaction throughputs for billions of people. You have to use higher layer technologies where you're, you know, abstracting away some of that confirmation time and you're batching transactions, right? Bitcoin at the base is a settlement.
I know a lot of entrepreneurs listen to this show, and NetSuite has been a huge supporter for entrepreneurs, for business owners, because there's one thing that we all know. Business is about making money, and it's about your bottom line. And the less you spend on the nuts and bolts of running your business, the more profits you keep. But these days, everything is costing more. Supplies, people, shipping. It squeezes your margins, and I've been there, juggling multiple systems for finance, inventory, you name it. Each with its own costs and its own set of headaches. That's why I made the switch to NetSuite by Oracle. It's changed our company. Think about it. NetSuite is one of the top financial systems out there. It puts your whole business on one platform, accounting, finance, the works. One data source for everyone. There's no more mismatched info. And because it's in the cloud, it slashes your IT costs. No more servers, no more updates. Just access NetSuite from anywhere. With one integrated suite, your overhead drops big time. And here's the real win. Efficiency. Everything's connected in NetSuite. Costs are ridiculous lately. Find a proven way to reduce your expenses and get better performance out of your team. It's a no-brainer, and that's what NetSuite offers. Over 37,000 companies have figured this out already. You have to join them. Right now, through to April 15th, NetSuite's got an incredible, flexible financing plan. Check it out and see the savings yourself at netsuite.com/ScottClary. That's netsuite.com/ScottClary. Think back to your last few days in the office. Did any of them leave you feeling really accomplished? Not the kind of day where you're running around like crazy, but where you've made real progress on something that matters. Because being busy doesn't always mean being productive, and I bet you we've all been there, and maybe it's time to rethink what it means to get things done. Today's episode is sponsored by Belay, and what they help you do is, instead of getting sucked into emails and to-do lists, they help you delegate tasks and focus on big goals. They can connect you with top-notch US-based talent who are ready to take on those time-consuming tasks that bog you down. Let's be real. There are way more important things you could be doing than bookkeeping or wrangling a packed inbox. They have virtual assistants to handle all of those pesky administrative tasks or accounting professionals to take care of all your financials. But here's the best part. You don't have to waste weeks searching for the right person. Belay's personalized matching service works quickly, sometimes matching you with the right talent to take stuff off your plate in under a week. Are you ready to try a different way of working? Check out Belay's list of the top 25 things you can delegate to a virtual assistant. It might just change your business and your life. Text SUCCESS, that's SUCCESS, to 55123 to get the list and to start transforming your to-do list with Belay. I don't know about you, but the idea of being harassed, scammed, or even worse, all because somebody found my personal information online, that's terrifying. Our political opinions, our addresses, even stuff about our families, it's out there for anyone to grab. And did you know that data brokers are allowed to sell information on over 98% of Americans? It's scary stuff. That's why I've partnered with Delete Me. I personally use Delete Me. They're a big friend of the podcast because I put myself out there online. So safety is a huge concern. It's really scary how easy it is to find someone's details and information, but Delete Me creates a layer of protection that we all need. You tell Delete Me what you want gone, and they make it disappear from those sketchy data broker sites. And Delete Me doesn't stop. They constantly monitor the web to keep your information off those lists. It's like having a privacy watchdog that never sleeps. You need to take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me. They're giving a special discount for all Success Story podcast listeners. Get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/success and use promo code success at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/success and enter code success at checkout. joindeleteme.com/success.
Layer. And that is why the block time is 10 minutes, because you need 10 minutes to synchronize the entire world, right? But you have to take into account the slowest possible node and have to propagate transactions and blocks to that slowest node. And about 10 minutes is right. Bitcoin is very much built around real world physics, right? So you have to factor in the speed of light. How long does it take for light to circumnavigate the globe? So there is no way that you can have everything settling on chain for a planetary population. You have to use things like Lightning, where not everything is written to a central repository, but individual nodes have their own map of the network themselves, and then they sync up on their own way.
And you mentioned something earlier that I thought was interesting. You mentioned that one of the outcomes of this particular battle could render Bitcoin, quote unquote, meaningless. But I would like to understand, because I don't know if there is across the board, I'm sure you have a very defined meaning for Bitcoin, but across the board, it doesn't seem like there is a universal understanding of what it should or should not be. So what is Bitcoin's meaning? Is it something that's supposed to be transactional? Is it something that's supposed to be a store of value, more symbolic of gold or something like that? And then I'm also curious about, if you are very bullish on Bitcoin, And I only know enough to be dangerous. So if I'm misspeaking, you tell me. But I'm not as into it as some people are. But if you are very bullish on Bitcoin, then I also want to understand the place that Ethereum and blockchains that, from my understanding, operate like an OS or an operating system, and you build things on them. So that's just sort of where I'm curious about, because I want to unpack that. But first, let's describe what Bitcoin is, how it has meaning versus what is a meaningless version of Bitcoin in your interpretation.
So I guess I'll go with the easy answer first, and is that the question is, am I bullish on Bitcoin? I'm very bullish on Bitcoin. I see Bitcoin as the ultimate end state, and that is what you're asking about earlier. What is hyper-Bitcoinization? Hyper-Bitcoinization is the point at which we don't convert back to fiat money, similar to how you don't convert dollars to seashells anymore. You might buy a seashell for a decorative thing or a necklace, but you're not going to buy seashells and hoard them to store value, right? But the other part is, what is Bitcoin? And the answer is very simple. Bitcoin is simply money. So it is all of those things that you mentioned. It is a store of value. It's a medium of exchange. And eventually it will be a unit of account. And on some levels, it's already a unit of account. But what is a useless version of Bitcoin? I would say that is Ethereum. Ethereum is centralized. It's basically a central bank digital currency at this point, because it's just big institutions running the chain. So it's kind of defeated the purpose already. You don't have
Is this similar to Ripple? Excuse me, just to understand, is that like similar to Ripple in terms of like decentralization?
It's similar to Ripple. It's similar to FTT. It's similar to everything. So you have Bitcoin on one side of the spectrum, which is decentralized, permissionless, immutable. And then you have everything else on varying levels of uselessness, right? So, you know, I think there are some cryptocurrencies that you could say are relatively decentralized, but for the most part, 99% of them, they're all masquerading as decentralized. They set up a Swiss foundation somewhere and they say, we're decentralized, but it's really Vitalik and his buddies deciding monetary policy. So you effectively have replaced the Federal Reserve with a bunch of guys, you know, on a Zoom call that know nothing about money, deciding what money is. And right now, I mean, they're on a kick to make Ethereum sound money. So they're trying to implement monetary policy and make it more valuable, right? Like reducing the supply, burning fees, locking things up so that people can't withdraw from staking pools or whatever. But that can change. Like if you can change in one direction, you can change in the other direction, right? So when Ethereum price is high, they can say, well, we need some inflation. We're going to print some more. And this is totally within their power to do. And this is why a lot of Bitcoiners call Ethereum a shitcoin, because it's so malleable. They can change anything they want. It was hacked. There was a DAO hack. They rolled it back on the chain. And I believe that was the inflection point for them to just fail. They could have
that
been.
Was also, I think that was the first like SEC investigation into anything crypto, if I'm not mistaken, wasn't it?
Perhaps. But I mean, Ethereum is really an unregistered security, and a lot of these things are unregistered securities, FTT included, but pretty much every crypto is an unregistered security. And this is why Bitcoiners try to distance ourselves from all those things, because they are trying to affinity scam and say, we're like Bitcoin, we're the same thing. And they want Bitcoin to be a subset of crypto, but it's actually very different.
Very interesting. And I'm super curious, because actually prepping for this interview, I saw you actually did a podcast with Vitalik, and I didn't realize, now I understand whoever the host was, I can't remember his name, but now I understand why he got you both on that call. Yeah. So if I didn't listen to the whole thing, and now I probably will after this, I should have. I didn't realize it was such like a contentious podcast, but if you were going to say this to Vitalik, what's Vitalik's argument? Because that's a pretty bold claim. And I've never heard this claim before that Ethereum's a shitcoin. I've heard that a lot of shitcoins are shitcoins, but not Ethereum.
Well, the thing is, every shitcoin likes to call other things shitcoins, and they think they're not, but they are. So I remember Do Kwon was like laughing at other things and saying, oh, they're all shitcoins, and you know, they're going to fail.
We know how that ended up.
Yeah, you know how that ended up, right? But Ethereum is just malleable. If you look at some of their early recordings of their meetups and things, they're talking about their ICO. I mean, that in itself is an indicator that it's a security, right? It's a effort by a group of people to make money and attract investment into their project. It's just that they don't have a company, right? But if you look at everything that Ethereum does, it's basically a company. A DAO is basically a board of directors, right? You're just saying it's a tokenized thing and therefore it's not under the existing framework. But I think regulators and you know, the CFTC and SEC, they're starting to understand that a lot of that's just bullshit. Like, it's really a securities offering that you're trying to pretend is decentralized. And I think the time is running out for these guys.
Now, then that sort of, this is a great way to sort of dovetail into the thing that I alluded to earlier, which is smart contracts built on Ethereum. I've never in my life heard of a smart contract, which is, again, if Ethereum's the OS, and you're saying it's a centralized OS, and the points you're making are very valid, then you have all these programs built on, all these smart contracts and all these other things that we've now, you know, it's blown up into everything from DeFi to NFTs to whatever. I'm not sure if they're all built on Ethereum. I don't think they are, but a lot of shit has been built on Ethereum. So I haven't seen much built on Bitcoin. So why has there not been more of an explosion in smart contracts and the understanding that Bitcoin can be an underlying OS for all these applications?
Well, you don't really need an underlying OS. The world doesn't need some sort of OS. And if it did have an OS, it should be decentralized. But there are things built on Bitcoin, but they're not the same scale as Ethereum, simply because the Silicon Valley money machine is not investing in companies building on top of sound money. Silicon Valley itself does not understand sound money. They don't even understand gold, barely. What they're interested in is a quick turnaround and a quick gain on their investment. Like, if you watch the All In podcast where you have Chamath and David Sacks and those guys, they're all talking about Solana and pumping their bags, right? But what the VCs want is super fast liquidity and turnaround on their investment. And they can achieve that through investing in these token projects that have no real purpose or utility. It's just an easy way to dump on retail investors. So they don't need to wait 7 to 10 years for a company to go public. They buy Solana in the pre-sale at a discount and sell it to retail investors, and then they're good, right? So this is why there's such a big, big push for all of these projects and smart contracts, right? At the end of the day, you're building smart contracts which are not necessarily immutable or unchangeable, because they build backdoors into them. If you Google smart contract backdoor, you'll see a lot of these smart contracts, they say, you know, code is law and they've written their rule set in here, but then there's like an access point where they can shut it off. And just like a 5-minute Google will show you, there's so many of these cases, and all of them are very insecure. If you Google DeFi hacks, you'll find pages and pages of hacks. Every week there's a DeFi hack, because they're just building JavaScript constructs that are insecure and have backdoors and centralized. So this is why none of this is really meaningful. Even a smart contract itself needs some sort of input. It's not like a smart contract will just run on its own. If you go back to the simple example of buying real estate, there has to be some proof that the transaction happens and then the funds are transferred, right? So there's always some input into these things. But the bigger problem is you're building smart contracts and DeFi stuff that is just relying on trading governance tokens or worthless tokens like Fruit dog tokens for other dog tokens and other governance tokens. So it's really a house of cards where you're staking some governance token to get another governance token to trade some other governance token. At the end of the day, none of the governance tokens even are meaningful, because they're centralized and it's a small group of people that's going to decide regardless of the governance token's direction or what they think should happen.
I just want to take a quick second and tell you about one more podcast you have to check out if you're a fan of Success Story. It's Sales Evangelist, hosted by Donald Kelly, brought to you by the HubSpot Podcast Network. Each week, Donald interviews the world's best sales experts, successful sellers, sales leaders, and entrepreneurs who share their strategies to succeed in sales right now. He brings on Jeffrey Gittimer, Jill Conrath, Bob Berg, Guy Kawasaki. They share actionable insights and stories that will encourage, challenge, and motivate you to hustle your way to more revenue for your business. If you're somebody who's looking to take off in your sales career, if you are an entrepreneur who's looking to sell more, I think all of us are, go listen to Sales Evangelist wherever you get your podcasts. So do you think that there's any application? Because I complain about this a lot. I feel like a lot of projects, and now, you know, this is tying into what you just said. A lot of projects seem to be trying to solve problems that the founders are creating that aren't real problems. I mean, if you look at the average person, They don't give a shit if they're transacting, whether or not the transaction they did is stored on the blockchain or not. Like, they could have, man, like the most popular CRM in the world is still Excel. Like, there's so many problems that are being created to be solved for that really have no reason being created. And that's, you know, if we talk about like fundamentals of entrepreneurship, I mean, you have to actually solve true pain points in the world, not just not make shit up. I feel like a lot of this stuff is making shit up.
Yeah. And they justify that by saying we have to innovate, right? And I going back to your earlier point, like, how would Vitalik defend Ethereum? He would say, you know, it's pushing the boundaries and innovating on things, but it's really not. Nothing they've done is really innovative at all. And nothing they do, like you're saying, is really useful in any real world situation, right? Ethereum, there's a video of a few Ethereum founders saying, we knew that Ethereum 1.0 would never scale. But when they were sourcing investment for their ICO, that was not the messaging. Right? They were saying this is done and it's a finished product and it's the world computer. But then they keep changing their narrative and they just haven't been nailed down to the cross yet about what they're actually doing, which is raising capital. If you want to innovate, simply innovate, write code. There's a saying, cypherpunks write code, but they're not writing code. They're soliciting investment for, you know, their little science experiment and not disclosing the risks, and they have no liabilities because it's not a legal structure. So it's kind of the worst of every single possible world combined.
With blockchain, is there innovation that you've seen? It can be with Bitcoin. It could be like, I'm thinking stable coins. Is there any need for any of this? What's something that you're actually excited about?
I'm really excited about a lot of peer-to-peer tech that the Bitfinex and Tether guys are working on. It's called Keet and Hole Punch, but they've built this product. You can check it out at keet.io, but it's a peer-to-peer messaging app, and they're getting ready to release the mobile version soon. But this is going to actually change a lot of things. So if Bitcoin is sound money, you still need a medium to engage with people that is not centralized, right? If you're still messaging people through, I don't know, WhatsApp or something, there's still a centralized server. And this can be shut off and it can be monitored. There's tons of metadata leaking everywhere. But if we can get to more of a peer-to-peer world, that, in my view, supports the peer-to-peer money, which is Bitcoin. So it's starting to fix the underlying problem with the world. Now, a lot of people throw out the term blockchain, but I think the innovation is really Bitcoin. The blockchain is really just the toxic waste that is generated to allow us to have Bitcoin, which is peer-to-peer cash that we can transact directly with one another. If it was possible to do that without a blockchain, that would be great, because the blockchain is just something that takes up space on your Bitcoin node, and it's growing every year. But that's the best solution we have right now. I think a lot of these second layer technologies, things like what Blockstream is working on and other companies, this will help alleviate that and allow Bitcoin to continue to grow and scale.
And then, so let's talk about that. So ameliorating Bitcoin, that's what Blockstream's mission is. And I think that's what you've worked on for, you know, now you're still working on that. I'm curious what Jan3 is doing, because I actually have no idea. And I went to the website, I couldn't find anything. So you're going to tell me what they're doing. But, and I think it's like probably still, because you're building it out, it's like still sort of a little bit new. But so the things that Blockstream is working on, so we're talking about Lightning Network, we're talking about making Bitcoin better and making Bitcoin more efficient. So what is the current state of Bitcoin? So what are the upper limits of what it can do that Blockstream's contributed and other people have contributed?
Well, there's no real upper limit because you're scaling Bitcoin with layers. So the Lightning Network, you can have a theoretical throughput of about 40 million transactions a second, right? There's no upper bound because you just keep adding more nodes and all of the traffic and interactions are between the different nodes. So if I'm not transacting with you, you don't need to know the transactions I've made. And this is how it becomes scalable. You can have multiple side chains. So a side chain is a blockchain that's anchored to Bitcoin. So right now there's Liquid, and you could potentially have other different sidechains. But the key is that they all settle back to Bitcoin and that they're using Bitcoin, and they didn't print a token to make themselves rich. So it's just all Bitcoin through and through, from Bitcoin base layer to layer two and beyond. And so, yeah.
Sorry, go ahead. No, go ahead.
I lost my train of thoughts. Okay.
Oh, no. Well, I was also going to say, so I'm trying to address all like the critiques, right? So the other one would be volatility. So your goal is to make it so that we don't keep bringing Bitcoin back to US dollars. And you're 100% right, because everyone, even if you say right now, like, you know, how much Bitcoin do you have, or what's your value? Like, psychologically, you're pinning it back to a US dollar amount, or maybe your local currency, right? So the goal is to eventually not do that. But I mean, the critique is volatility. I can't, what is it? I think it's by a cup of coffee or some. there's some de facto like transaction that we should be able to do that's hard to do if prices increase, decrease, go all over the map.
Yeah, so Bitcoin is volatile because it's still growing, but it's important to put everything into perspective. So Bitcoin is like 13 years old. It's still a baby, really. And it's actually quite impressive that it's grown this much in, you know, a decade plus. It's the same with the iPhone. Like, the iPhone has only been around for a very short amount of time. I think it was first out in 2009 or something like that. I remember switching my BlackBerry for an iPhone, but it hasn't been around that long. But now it's very ubiquitous. And that whole smartphone form factor kind of emerged from that, right? So things can change very quickly, especially with fiat currencies, because they are inherently defective, because the central banks can print it as much as they want. There is no check and balance here. And Bitcoin is just a superior money because you know that there is a set amount of Bitcoin. It's 21 million, and that can be subdivided into 100 million per coin. So you know the rule set, you know what you're getting into. And one example I like to give is that Bitcoin is a ruler with a finite amount of, you know, units on that ruler. There's no such ruler for financial circles. Like, but people, I guess, measure in dollars, but you can't measure in dollars because the supply is constantly fluctuating up and down, right? You have, kilometers or miles for distance. You have ounces and milliliters and liters for volume. But what do you use to measure monetary value? It's going to be Bitcoin, because that's the only thing that's really set in stone. Everything else is just someone's printing paper, and or not even paper now, just a database entry, and it's changing every single day. And, you know, the interest rates and everything change too on a weekly or monthly basis.
So then, okay, so we understand that maybe...
Today's show is brought to you by 1Password. Now listen, we all have that one friend who's constantly forgetting passwords and needing help to get into their accounts. I have a solution. It's called 1Password. 1Password is the award-winning password manager trusted by millions of users and companies like IBM and Slack to keep logins, credit cards, and other private info safe in an encrypted vault that only you can access. No more sticky notes with passwords or using the same password everywhere. I've been using 1Password for a year now, and I can't recommend it enough. It saves me time from having to reset passwords and gives me peace of mind knowing my info is secure. With convenient features like automatic password generation and login autofill, 1Password takes the hassle out of passwords. You can use it on all your devices, iOS, Android, Mac, PC. Everything syncs seamlessly. And with top-notch security audits and encryption, your data stays private. So do yourself a favor and check out 1Password today. Go to 1Password.com/Clary and get a 2-week free trial. Let 1Password remember all of your logins for you so you can remember what really matters. That's 1Password.com/Clary for 2 weeks free. Today's sponsor is BetterHelp. Now, hear me out. If you magically had an extra hour in a day, and I know sometimes that's the only time we get to ourselves, what would you do with it? Maybe you would catch up on sleep. Maybe you'd hit the gym. Maybe you'd finally get into that book that you've been eyeing. We're always wishing for more time. But what if we focused on how we use the time that we have? Think about what really lights you up. What would change in your life if you made that a priority? Do you even know what that thing is? Well, therapy has been a game changer for me, not because of some terrible thing that's happened to me, but because it's helped me figure out what matters, how to manage tough emotions, how to be a better friend, a partner, business person, and just really person all around. So if you're even a little curious about therapy, if you want to help think through what matters to you, what to prioritize, how to live your life, try BetterHelp. It's totally online and works around your crazy schedule. No awkward waiting rooms. Just get matched with a licensed therapist and start making the most of the time you've already got. Learn how to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/successpod today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp.com/successpod.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
The printing money is not a great thing, and I think we've seen a lot of issues with countries printing money over COVID more than ever before. So your goal, I guess, is this with Jan 3 now, you're trying to get countries to adopt or help me understand, because I know there's El Salvador, and there's, help me understand, like, countries adopting Bitcoin versus stable coins versus CBDC, which seems to be the route that everyone's worried a country will take if they like the idea of digital currency. Walk me through that and sort of what you're doing.
Right. So what we're doing is we have a wallet that we're developing called the Aqua Wallet. It would be for Bitcoin and stablecoin. So the US dollar denominated value instrument is not going away anytime soon. And stablecoins are a useful thing that can help give access to the financial system to people in the global south. If you can't open a bank account, you can still get Tether. And that is a useful tool. So back to your earlier point, is there anything useful with the blockchain? Well, having a stablecoin on a chain or without a chain, like, for example, other protocols that are more like the Lightning Network, do add value. But it's not necessarily about the chain. Now, I think when I joined Blockstream, it was about augmenting Bitcoin and doing some things to help scale Bitcoin and basically cut off that sort of attack vector where people say Bitcoin cannot scale, because now it is clear that Bitcoin can scale. So that is done. But we have new attacks that are going to come in the next few years or decades on Bitcoin too, such as CBDCs. I would say that's a form of attack. I don't believe it will be a successful attack, but it's a type of attack. And then you have misinformation, a lot at the government levels. We saw some examples in the US where you had some people saying, you know, Bitcoin is controlled by a few developers and a few mining pools, and therefore it can be regulated. And we want software developers to register themselves and whatnot, right? But these are bad things, and it's a bad direction for human civilization in general, because that's just leading to authoritarian 1984 type of life for everybody in the world, where you're constantly under surveillance and there's zero freedom. So I think Bitcoin is the bulwark against that. And what we hope to do is to get more countries like El Salvador adopting a Bitcoin standard. And a part of that is really just reteaching people what money is. Money is meant to be a mechanism by which we exchange our time and value. It's not supposed to be something that a central bank is managing, and it's not supposed to be a tool by which you can surveil people, and is definitely not something you should be using to try to manipulate the prosperity of a nation, right? But all of these things are happening, and I think the work we're doing to engage at a nation state level can help to defend against that, because we can educate legislators and members of parliament or Congress, like, what is Bitcoin and what is money, and why is money critical to the success of a nation state, and why having sound monetary policy will prevent things like inflation and hyperinflation down the road.
And how do you plan on convincing a nation state that they should adopt Bitcoin, like El Salvador is trying to do, versus a CBDC? Because it seems like a CBDC is totally in line with what a country would want to accomplish. As much as I hate it, but people, like, it makes sense that if I was trying to have better control over or track my citizens and outside of them pushing back, it serves the interests of the government.
Well, the key here is to change the interests of the government so that they're more pro-freedom. So going back home to Canada, it's supporting people like Pierre Poilievre that are talking about freedom, sound fiscal policy, and just common sense things like we shouldn't be buying oil from overseas when we have oil domestically, right? These things are just nonsensical if you think about it and you step back. There are countries that are energy independent that just put themselves in a place to be dependent and cede sovereignty. And I think Bitcoin is a step to restore a lot of that, but not just Bitcoin itself, but the first principles thinking around Bitcoin, like why, what is money? How do we become independent? How do we not be reliant on others? And how do we do things that make basic sense, right? A lot of the world has forgotten about what money is. People think it's just a number in my bank account.
1,000%. 1,000%, yeah. I mean,
but it's the same for energy. People forget you need energy. Human civilization is dependent on energy. But because you're comfortable, you have lights on and heat in your house, you forget what that comes from. And people also don't understand how energy is produced. And they think, we have to go green. It's got to be all solar and wind. But you don't start tracking environmental impact from the point at which you buy that solar panel. That has a life before it is available for purchase. It has to be mined. The solar panels themselves, the photovoltaic leaves have to be made, and they're made with coal. And then at the end of life, it has to be disposed. But it's almost like they look at this narrow slice of the thing and say, from the point I buy it to here, it's green, therefore it's good. But you ignore the beginning and the end of the thing. It's like going to the grocery store and saying, yeah, meat is good. Like it just appears in the grocery store magically, right? But this is what we're living with.
I know we're living with it, but I mean, you're taking on a it's a very good thing you're taking on, but it's a monumental task because people are so stressed about their immediate vicinity and the things they can touch and feel and smell and taste that it's hard to get people out of their own bubble, right? And that's what you're saying you're doing. You're getting governments out of their own bubble. You're getting people out of their own bubble and their immediate surroundings saying, listen, we're trying to do this for the betterment of humanity, and this is why. That's a monumental task.
Well, but it's all that we can do, right? And a lot of what we're doing is just simply being a resource and engaging and trying to educate and point people in the right direction. But ultimately, people have to change. Governments have to change. If it's Canada, then Trudeau has to go. And we need new leadership that understands basic fundamental economics and monetary policy and why you need fiscal responsibility to step in. But maybe we can be a resource and affect change that way. But that's what we're trying, at least. All we can do is try.
And walk me through. Okay, so like let's use El Salvador as a case study. Maybe there's other countries that are probably further along than Canada and the US. So what is a good adoption of Bitcoin, and what's the proper terminology to bring Bitcoin into a country? What's the verbiage for that?
I just say Bitcoin adoption. Just keeping it simple.
Fine. That's fine. Let's do that. So what's a country that's doing it properly? How are they doing it? Walk me through like a case study.
Well, I would say El Salvador is the best example we have right now. They've made Bitcoin legal tender, which means basically Bitcoin is money. And you don't have to deal with capital gains tax on Bitcoin, on money. Because you can't have Bitcoin acting as money if you have to track every transaction and report cap gains on it, right? And this is part of that greater initiative that we have at Jan 3, which is educating people about what money is. Why do you have inflation? Why do you have problems? Why is the economy contracting? It's because you're not treating money as money. You're treating it as a tool for various purposes, but definitely not money. Canada itself has a new law coming into effect early January, which is denying foreign buyers the ability to buy property in Canada. But how do you expect to grow the economy? How do you expect to have more immigration if you're restricting capital inflow into the country, right? You can't really squeeze blood from a stone. And this is why people want tourism, why people want investments. And I think El Salvador is on the right track because they're saying Bitcoin is money. All the diaspora of El Salvador around the world remit money back home. Money is money. People should invest in El Salvador, come to visit El Salvador for tourism purposes, right? I mean, if you go back to Canada, you get the third degree. Like, why are you coming back? And that's if you're a Canadian. But they do that to tourists too. Like, why are you coming to Canada? And this is just a symptom of a misunderstanding of how the world works and how money works, right? And I think
this is relatively recent. Like, I mean, like, even in Canada, it's relatively recent. Like, from my understanding, previous to COVID, like, Canada had one of the best immigration and refugee programs in the world. So I don't think that it was always like closing its borders. I know that they probably closed borders for a significant period of time, more longer than most countries. But do you think this is like a symptom of like government, like Trudeau, and this is not going away? I haven't been there in a year and a half, so.
Well, I would say it's a symptom of just governments in general. Like, you're either using money as money, or you're entering into some protectionism mode where you're thinking that you're protecting what you've got, but you're basically committing yourself to a slow decline, right? If you look at history and the growth of the four Asian tigers, they grew very rapidly in the past few decades, and that was because they're welcoming investment capital in, right? You want to invest because you can, you know, move your money in easily. But with things like capital controls and restriction of funds and even, you know, cutting people's bank accounts off and making it very difficult to move and transact money, that just results in economic stalemate and death eventually. So the hope is that El Salvador can reinvigorate this and make people understand. But even in Switzerland, you have a good example, right? The Swiss love money. They want you to bring money to Switzerland, buy Swiss property, put your money into Swiss banks, and then they can grow and invest. But, you know, most countries don't see that. But I think that we're reaching an inflection point where they are starting to understand this, because they're seeing Swiss inflation is pretty flat. And then every other country around that's trying to use money as a tool for surveillance and control is suffering.
And I'm curious about one of the aspects that you mentioned, the negative aspects of CBDC, which is surveillance. But it's funny, you know this as well as I do, like Bitcoin, everyone kept saying originally, like way, way, way back, it was used for illicit means and it was only used to buy drugs on Silk Road. And now everybody knows that it's probably easier to trace a drug transaction through Bitcoin than it is through actual cash. But to that point then, right now, I'm curious about privacy. So if you do have a country that adopts Bitcoin as legal tender, do you not run into some of the same problems as a CBDC? Because you can trace everything that anyone's ever bought anywhere.
Yes and no. I mean, if you're using Bitcoin through Lightning, it is private, right? It's a restoration of the cash property to money. And I think the other good thing about some of our initiatives is that we can educate people that cash is a good thing, right? It's a way to ensure democracies can be open and free, because you can have the right to protest and assemble and have free speech, but if you can cut off the monetary spigot, you can stop all of that stuff, right? If you look at protests around the world, there's a few things they try to do in authoritarian regimes, which is cut off the internet and trace money, like see if people spent money on the subway to get to the protest and then go and find them and make sure that they suffer after the fact. And we had that in Canada too. If you donated to the truckers, yeah, we're shutting your account down, right? So this is the problem.
That is an issue.
Yeah, cash is very important. And it's the key to any semi-functioning democracy that people can have their own money. So the separation of money and state is of critical importance if you want freedom, because the tendency is towards less freedom, because as the government becomes more fearful of the populace, they want to enforce more and more measures to prevent any threat to them. But that's not in the best interest of a country, right? Like, if you look at China, they had zero COVID policies. And then when people actually started protesting, they gave up those policies, right? And you could say the same in Canada. If there was no freedom convoy or trucker protest, would we be opening up right now? And it's questionable.
No, I appreciate that. Okay. I want to give you, like, we went through a ton of great stuff, and I appreciate that, because like I mentioned before, I get a lot of different perspectives on various, but I've never had somebody who so well-versed in Bitcoin, to be quite honest. So I really appreciate it. No, it's actually been like really educational for me, which I mean, it means it's always a good show. Any final thoughts on last things that are hyper important that I didn't ask that you should teach over to the audience? Sort of like the floor is yours. And then I'll make sure that people like know where to reach out to you and connect with you and whatnot.
Yeah, I think we've covered a wide range of topics. I would just leave it to your audience to maybe think about what money is and how you can protect yourself. There are a lot of Bitcoiners that reach these conclusions on their own. Michael Saylor is one such person. He's thinking of the macroeconomic scale at a company level, right? How do I, as a company, protect the money I have, the cash I have? And that's rapidly devaluing. He's likening it to an ice cube that's melting. So that was why he implemented the corporate policy at MicroStrategy to buy Bitcoin. And that's been a good move for them. Now, people might say you're down because Bitcoin is down, but that's if you're thinking of things on a very short time horizon. And one of the things that Bitcoin does is it puts your thinking on longer timescales, right? Most people are not buying Bitcoin for themselves, but for their children or future generations. Like if you can mine fiat currency, mine Canadian dollars and mine US dollars, you're okay. But what you want is to have generational wealth that can be passed on, right? And you want a better future for your children and their children, because nobody wants their children to live in a 1984 type hellscape where they're monitored constantly, right? That's not a world you want to bring new life into. So Bitcoin makes you think on the longer time horizon, and it makes you understand a lot more of the world in the context of how money works, because we've largely forgotten what money is, and we've taken it for granted.
Amazing. If people want to, you have a book. Have you written a book or not?
No, it's on my to-do list.
Okay. It sounds like you've written a book, but okay. So if people want to reach out to you, learn more about what you're working on, what's the best place for them to connect with you?
I'm pretty active on Twitter. So my handle is Excellion, Excellion. And that's basically it. And one day I will write a book.
Okay, cool. Very good. I asked this question to everyone to close it out. So after your entire career, multiple successes, built various companies, and you're an entrepreneur yourself, what does success look like for you at the end of the day?
Well, I think success should just be happiness. You should be happy with where you are in life and what you have. I think understanding Bitcoin simplifies a lot of that, because you understand, you know, very material things, status symbols, and they're not really meaningful in the end. And you know, you should just be happy with the people around you and what you're doing in life. That, to me, is a success.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early, so everyone can go home on time. There's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts, so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.